White Area and Resistance Radio calling. White Area and Resistance Radio calling. This is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, in the bunker right here in North Central Indiana on a rainy, cool day. Not too bad, though. Yes. Well, anyhow, it is the 3rd of January, 2015. And 2014's gone, but Obama's still here. How about that? Saturn's Day. Well, it's time to get some donations in to P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Now, we were talking about Dr. Feelgood yesterday, and I started to record the rest of the book, but the problem is that the first maybe two-thirds of the book is not what we're looking at. It's looking at his childhood and what he liked to do and how he got into the medical business as a doctor and like that, and a whole lot of stuff that we're not that interested in. But we do know he started out over there in Germany and Poland, and he was in Czechoslovakia and all kinds of stuff. So I've got an interview here on the radio that I think will suffice and be a lot better than trying to do that whole CD on Dr. Feelgood, Samuel Jacobson. So here we go. It does tell here how once he got over to Czechoslovakia, he lost control of the formula he was using. So that's when that happened. And then there was a number of people using his formula, and one drug company put a bunch of pills together with his formula like that. So the cat was out of the bag.
Well, good morning. This is the Lou Rockwell Show, and how great to have as our guest this morning, Mr. Bill Burns, William J. Burns. Bill Burns is, I guess I could take up the whole show talking about his qualifications, all the books he's written, the TV shows he's hosted, his work as a literary agent, but I want to talk today about his really extraordinary book that he's co-authored with Richard A. Lertzman. It's called Dr. Feelgood, The Shocking Story of the Doctor Who May Have Changed History by Treating and Drugging JFK, Marilyn, Elvis, and Other Prominent Figures. So, Bill, Dr. Max Jacobson was John F. Kennedy's doctor. He injected him with methamphetamines, right, and a lot of other people with methamphetamines, and this had a huge effect, for example, you point out, on the first Kennedy-Nixon debate.
Yes, I mean, our contention in the book is that here's the story of how a drug managed to get itself addicted with various very high-profile individuals and actually changed the course of American history, probably world history, and had it not been for Max Jacobson's treatment of JFK in 1960, especially prior to the first debate, but also during the campaign, Nixon, who was ahead in the polls going into that first debate in 1960, would probably have remained ahead in the polls and possibly won the presidential election. That would have been very likely. But when Kennedy walked into Jacobson's office, he was a candidate, and he was completely wiped out, totally fatigued, in unbelievable pain in his back. He was walking on crutches for most of the time and had a whole constellation of symptoms. He had irritable bowel syndrome. He had digestive issues. He had certainly had severe back pain because he'd injured his back. But he was also heavily fatigued. He was drained. He had Addison's disease. And with Jacobson's injections did, they were 30 milligrams of methamphetamine. What they did was give Kennedy an enormous amount of perceived energy covering up a lot of his symptoms. When he came back to Jacobson before that first debate, he had no voice. He was hoarse and sick. And what Jacobson did was he injected Kennedy directly into his larynx, directly into his voice box. And immediately, within minutes, Kennedy's energy returned, his voice returned, and he really overpowered Nixon on that first debate, and the polls shifted after that first debate from Nixon's being slightly ahead to Kennedy's being slightly ahead, and the polls never changed after that first debate, even though Nixon won the subsequent debates.
Well, very interesting, and of course, he continued to inject Kennedy, and inject a lot of other people. Tell us a little bit before we go on about other famous people and what maybe the consequences of these injections were. Tell us about Jacobson's background.
He'd gotten his medical degree in Berlin all the way back right about the time of World War I, and he had done his residency in surgery. And at that time, we're talking 1919, 1918, at that time, antiseptic procedures in operating rooms were very lax. In fact, one of the things Jacobson said, because we have a lot of his quotes, one of the things Jacobson said was that even minor operations were successful, but the infection rate was so high that a lot of patients died. So it was the old statement, yeah, the operation was a success, too bad the patient died. And that was because of the antiseptic procedures. They just didn't exist. Patients died of all kinds of infection. So Jacobson tried to avoid surgery as much as possible. And he focused on a movement in Germany in the medical profession that said that when treating a neuromuscular disease or a blood issue, if you could affect a cure to someone's blood, add rejuvenating components to the person's blood, then the blood itself, as ludicrous as it sounds, that the blood itself would affect the healing. So it was kind of a strange version of homeopathic healing. So what Jacobson did was he was using all these regenerative tissue from other animals. He would use human stem cells. He would use eel glands. Eels are great because they're like earthworms. Cut an eel, and the eel simply grows a new part that you've cut off. So he thought, maybe I could apply that to human beings. He was using the sexual organs of sheep and goats and things like that, as well as human placentas. So imagine this guy experimenting with that kind of material, those kinds of chemicals. To test the effectiveness of how these drugs would make a person feel, Jacobson began injecting himself and got phenomenally sick, but then recovered. And he thought, since I've recovered, if I covered up the ill effects, the instant shock effects of these drugs with methamphetamine, which was heavily in use in Germany right about the end of World War I, if I could do that, maybe my patients will not feel the ill effects of my drugs. They'll feel good while the other elements, the other chemicals, are affecting a cure. And that's how he concocted his special vitamin injections. They weren't vitamins at all. They were methamphetamines. And he began injecting himself. But the problem with methamphetamine is that the methamphetamine molecule, and this is why it works, that the methamphetamine molecule mimics the shape of a chemical called dopamine, and that's a neurochemical. Dopamine hits the pleasure centers of the brain, and when it does, it makes somebody feel good. That's the whole point of Dr. Feelgood. So what Jacobson decided to do was use methamphetamine to cover up the ill effects of the chemicals, and in so doing, he thought, while the person's body is rejuvenating, they'd feel good. That's how Jacobson discovered this particular drug, and he began using it on his patients in Germany, and then after the Nazis came to power and Jacobson fled to Prague and Vienna and then Paris, he began using it as a regular drug. And because it, now remember, this is the same drug that's in chemicals today, Ritalin and Adderall for ADHD, right? Because it helps you focus. It's in much lower amounts, but it's the same drug. So Jacobson began to make people feel good. And these were celebrity clients, first in Paris, then in New York. And his reputation grew as a doctor who would give you an injection that would make you feel good, hence his name, Dr. Feelgood. And that's what drew Kennedy to seek Jacobson for help when he was fatigued and very, very sick during the fall election in 1960.
What was the connection? How did he know to go to Dr. Feelgood?
One of Kennedy's best friends was his old college roommate, Chuck Spaulding. Remember those little pink rubber balls? Spaulding balls?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Chuck Spaulding from that family. Well, Chuck Spaulding was a patient, as well as another person called Mark Shaw. And here's where the story gets really interesting. Mark Shaw was a photographer. He was a high fashion photographer. He was the guy who did all those celebrity books on Audrey Hepburn, and a lot of great stars traveled the world photographing stars. But Mark Shaw, who was friends with Chuck Spaulding, by the way, Mark Shaw had been in the OSS in World War II. He was a pilot. He was in the OSS in World War II, and after the war became what's known as a non-official cover officer. It's called a NOC, a non-official cover officer for the CIA. Basically, he was a CIA asset, but he wasn't one of the analysts, you know, basically covering, you know, doing the work. He was basically like Mission Impossible. He was kind of a spy. Part of the virtue of having somebody in the CIA who was a fashion photographer was he was going all over the world with a perfect, perfect cover. I mean, imagine the cover. You're photographing all these stars in Switzerland and France and Germany and all over the world, but you really are a CIA agent, so you're reporting on what you're seeing. Mark Shaw was also a patient of Max Jacobson and a good friend of Max Jacobson. So the CIA had a guy who was literally in Jacobson's entourage. The aspect of Max Jacobson that was also fascinating was that in the 1930s in Vienna, before obviously he went to Paris and then New York, was that he was turned by Soviet secret services. This is before the KGB and before the military and KVD. He became a Soviet operative, and he was dealing with Soviet spies in Europe. And one of his reasons was that the Soviets were opposing Hitler, and he had to flee Germany because of Hitler. So he saw the Soviets as a counterforce. But by the time he came to the United States, he was heavily involved with Soviet agents. So you've got this doctor who is treating all these celebrities, who literally is a Soviet listening post in New York, and one of his patients is a CIA non-official cover officer, so it's almost like a spy versus spy. When Kennedy comes into the picture through his college roommate, Chuck Spalding, both the CIA and the FBI, both of whom were surveilling Jacobson, knew that they suddenly had a great asset in Max Jacobson, albeit unwilling, and hence the spy story begins to move forward.
Well, interesting. Do you think either the KGB or the CIA or both of them wanted Kennedy on methamphetamines for their own reasons?
The CIA didn't want him on methamphetamines because the CIA realized that a person on methamphetamines could be very dangerous. Kennedy's behavior was behavior that was typical of a meth addict. He gravitated between extraordinarily high mania. See, the thing is, the more meth you inject, the more it takes to get that feel-good feeling because your brain is being flooded with dopamine, and it becomes, like any other drug, resistant to the effects of methamphetamine. So you need more meth to make you feel good. And that was the problem with Kennedy. He kept on upping his doses. And that worried the CIA. And, of course, they knew what was going on because they knew what Max Jacobson was doing. They were surveilling his office. And they had their own guy inside Max Jacobson's office, Mark Shaw. Kennedy began acting out in these bizarre ways. He began running naked through the Carlyle Hotel. He was seeing a lot of call girls and prostitutes. He was having prostitutes come to the White House. He would arrange these assignations, these trysts with prostitutes in New York. He'd slip away from his Secret Service detail. All the time he was high on meth when he was doing this, because one of the effects that methamphetamine has is, besides this feeling of hyper-grandiosity, right? You can rule the world, you're king of the world, that stuff. It's also hypersexuality, and that is what was affecting Kennedy. And Seymour Hirsch writes about this in his book, The Dark Side of Camelot. So Kennedy was heavily affected by that, but he was also taking LSD, and he was also taking other drugs. So the CIA was very worried about having a president under the influence of these drugs that were making him behave in bizarre ways.
Tell us, Bill, about, you know, other important people. I mean, this story, Jacobson and methamphetamine and related items, tells us something about the murder of Marilyn Monroe as well.
Right. Well, Jacobson was very influential within the entertainment community, both in New York and Hollywood. One of his patients was Billy Wilder. Another one was Cecil B. DeMille, Alan J. Lerner, who wrote Camelot and other play, My Fair Lady. Tennessee Williams was a patient. So was Truman Capote, who wrote In Cold Blood, Breakfast at Tiffany's. He had a very high literary and show business clientele. And one of the people who was spreading the Jacobson gospel was this publicity agent called Milton Blackstone. Blackstone was Eddie Cantor's agent. He was Eddie Fisher's agent. He got the singer Eddie Fisher, who married Debbie Reynolds, Princess Leia's father, right? Eddie Fisher became quickly addicted and got into that coterie. Jacobson became so influential within the Hollywood community this is in the 1950s, that his other patients were people like Marilyn Monroe, who was brought to Jacobson by Paula Strasberg at the Actors Studio. She became a patient in the 1950s. Reginald Rose, Patty Chayefsky, Rod Serling, all were visiting Max Jacobson, actor Bob Cummings. And so his influence was spreading through the entertainment community. The issue with Marilyn Monroe is that she was already an at-risk individual, extraordinarily vulnerable. She'd been raped by her stepfather, sexually assaulted by her stepfather, her own father. She didn't even know who he was. She'd been passed from family to family in foster care. She was extraordinarily needy. Her marriages had failed. She'd married Joe DiMaggio. That failed. Her first marriage had failed. DiMaggio was her second marriage. Then she married Arthur Miller. That failed. I mean, she was really an unhappy, depressed person. So the injections from Max Jacobson made her feel good. But the problem was that the more she had, the more she needed. So finally, she's seeing Kennedy. She's having an affair with Jack Kennedy. And she's invited to sing Happy Birthday to him at his birthday party in at Madison Square Garden. This is 1962. But Marilyn Monroe did not perform live on stage. She was a movie actress. So she's performing before the camera, not before a live audience, which meant you could do any kind of retakes, set up a scene again, do editing. Doing a performance live was a frightening thing to her, as it was for Jackie Kennedy, by the way, who was also a Max Jacobson patient. So Marilyn Monroe, she's set to go on. She's in this phenomenally sexy, skin-tight dress, and she refuses to go on stage. She refuses to sing. I can't do it. I'm afraid. So what the Kennedys did was, they got Jacobson to give her a massive injection of methamphetamines that put her into a kind of a stumble-bum stupor. So she goes on stage, sings Happy Birthday, Mr. President, but she's not drunk. She's high on meth at the time. And then in a pit of depression, and she's being watched by Peter Lawford, right? She's back in L.A. She's being watched by Peter Lawford. She starts making threats against the president. Oh, I'm going to tell the press about that secret airbase you have in Nevada. I'm going to tell the press about how you're trying to kill Fidel Castro. And the CIA is taping her. They've wiretapped her phone. So they're taping all this stuff, and they're transcribing it. And they realize from what she's threatening Bobby Kennedy with that Jack Kennedy has been talking out of school. He's been divulging state, really highly classified secrets to his girlfriend. Now they're on alert. Who else is Kennedy talking to? Is he talking to the prostitutes he's dealing with? Is he doing pillow talk with other women? Another mistress Kennedy had was Mary Meyer. Mary Meyer had been married to Cord Meyer, who was a CIA agent, and she was a Kennedy mistress, and she was good friends with him. Besides having sexual affairs with him, they were good friends. And she'd go back and forth to Harvard, because they knew each other from Harvard. And she was bringing LSD from Timothy Leary to Kennedy. So what was Kennedy telling Mary Meyer about state secrets? Well, whatever it was, she was writing it in her diary. So a year after Kennedy is assassinated, Mary Meyer is killed in Georgetown, and the CIA, specifically James Jesus Angleton, who was the head of the counter-espionage unit of the CIA, he was a big counter-spy guy, he breaks into Mary Meyer's house to steal her diary. And who discovers them in the house? None other than Mary Meyer's sister, Tony Bradley. But Tony Bradley is married to Ben Bradley of the Washington Post, who strikes a deal with Angleton. This is all fact. This is not supposition. Strikes a deal with Angleton here. Take the diary and give it back. Angleton takes the diary. He reads it. He suggests to Ben Bradley and Tony Bradley that this diary really should be destroyed. Of course, Tony Bradley, she was very old when we interviewed her, of course, told us exactly what was in the diary. It was state secrets. Kennedy was talking to her and intermingling, mixed in with Kennedy's visions of a progressive one-world government and things like that, all stuff that we take for granted today. In there were stories about things like the secret air base in Nevada, outside of Rachel, Nevada. Now we call it Area 51. What kind of stuff they were working on. They were building the SR-71, the Blackbird, the spy plane, things like that. And other kinds of things. So that's what was going on with Kennedy and Mary Meyer. I mean, she was killed because they knew that Mary Meyer knew some of the secrets. But that was the extent of Max Jacobson's influence upon everybody.
Also, Elvis was given these drugs. Do you think that helped bring on his early death?
Well, the story of Elvis was that Colonel Parker, who was not a colonel, who was not even an American, in fact, he fled from Eastern Europe because he'd murdered somebody, that was Colonel Parker. Colonel Parker was a Max Jacobson patient, along with a lot of other people like Mickey Mantle and people like that. Max Jacobson patient. Colonel Parker, seeing Elvis Presley's energy begin to flag, suggested Presley get a shot from Max. Well, Presley said that when he got the injection from Jacobson, he felt as though his whole body was on fire. And even though Presley took other stimulants, Presley said he was frightened to death of the effect of methamphetamines on his system. But depending upon who we spoke to, whether it was Eddie Fisher, whether it was this other person, Mike Salmick, who was one of Jacobson's best friends, Presley was a repeat patient. Other people said, no, Presley took an injection once and that was the end of it. So that's kind of up in the air, but we know that Presley did visit Max Jacobson because Colonel Parker set that up.
Wow. Well, this is an extraordinary book, Bill Burns, that you are the co-author of, Dr. Feelgood. I hope everybody buys it and reads it because it's quite a story, quite an amazing...
About President John F. Kennedy's famous first debate with Richard... Camelot. My next guest say JFK was energized because of methamphetamine from an infamous doctor who actually laid the foundation for methamphetamine and the drug culture in this country in large measure, or so they contend. Joining us now are the authors, Richard Lertzman and William Burns, authors of the brand new book, Dr. Feelgood. I want to read the whole subtitle, because when a subtitle is this long, there's a reason for it. It's the shocking story of the doctor who may have changed history by treating and drugging JFK, Marilyn, Elvis, and other prominent figures. Gentlemen, thanks and congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rick, let me start with this. The book starts out, your research and pulling it all together some time ago, to be about Robert Cummings, a well-known, popular actor who didn't fit any part of what befell him. Tell us what happened, how it became about JFK very quickly, if you can.
Bob Cummings was a great actor who was known as a health fanatic. And in our research, through Art Linkletter and through Dwayne Hickman, who played Dobie Gillis, we found out that Bob Cummings was a methamphetamine addict, and it destroyed his life.
And destroyed his life, and you conducted interviews from, 2004-05 on to last year. You talked with George Clooney, Jerry Lewis, Yogi Berra, all about Dr. Max Jacobson's patients, the president. The idea that the president, everyone has a sense of that there was something wrong, painkillers, that sort of thing. But to be injected, and as you point out, before the debate, I don't want to give away too much, but to be injected with methamphetamines, it may have actually changed his performance in the first debate with Richard Nixon.
Well, remember, Nixon was ahead of Kennedy in the polls going into that first debate. And people saw Kennedy as...
By the way, I have to tell you the truth. I had forgotten that until I read it in the book.
Right. He was ahead in the polls. He was considered a lot of gravitas. And not only did Kennedy get a shot of this methamphetamine formula that gave him energy when he was barely walking. He was so tired. He was so fatigued. He had no voice left. And Nixon was also suffering from a malady. He had bumped his knee. He had an infected knee. Kennedy tricked him into not putting makeup on, walks in like a gymnast, and the polls shifted that night. Kennedy was ahead in the polls after that debate and stayed ahead through the whole course of the campaign.
Let's go to Marilyn Monroe, Mickey Mantle. To have all of these popular cultural icons involved in this, and this guy, a German immigrant, Dr. Jacobson, injecting all of these people, the web that reaches out across Hollywood to Washington, it's extraordinary.
He really reached out and really changed our society, and he stayed under the radar the entire time. I mean, he treated Leonard Bernstein. He treated Anthony Quinn. His office was a New York who's who, starting at 10 o'clock at night to 4 in the morning. You could come in and see Truman Capote and Tennessee Williams. The gift at 4 a.m. was a methamphetamine shot to everybody who stayed. And it was a who's who of New York, Hollywood, or the world.
And you assert that this was the foundation of the drug culture in this country?
Absolutely. Methamphetamines were legal in 1960. And it was only after the Jacobson expose in the 1970s that we started the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, that the drug war began, and it was in large measure because of Max Jacobson.
I hope you'll come back, because we want to talk about how this book is being blocked by some prominent media that apparently don't like the idea that JFK would be in any way revealed to the American people. We're going to have to leave it there.
Well, let's get away from the myth a little bit here and go to something quite a bit different, and that is England, what's happening over there and happening here too as far as that's concerned. The title of this is Hope for the Child Victims of Rotherham. Britain was shocked by the content of a report published in August revealing massive sexual exploitation of teens in and around the town of Rotherham. For more than 15 years, predators, mostly Pakistani men, have horrifically abused hundreds of youths, mostly white girls, and authorities have looked the other way. The report written by Professor Alex Jay found that between 1997 and 2013, about 1,400 minors were sexually exploited, and that's a conservative estimate. Quote, it's hard to describe the appalling nature of the abuse that these child victims suffer, unquote. The report states, even in the dry, factual language of an official report, it is difficult reading. The children were raped by multiple perpetrators, trafficked to other towns and cities in north of England, abducted, beaten, intimidated, the report says. There were examples of children who had been doused in gasoline and threatened to be of being set alight, fire, threatened with guns, made to witness brutally violent rapes, and threatened they would be next if they told anyone. Girls as young as 11 were raped by large numbers of male Pakistani perpetrators. This abuse is not confined to the past, but continues to this day, unquote. One young person told us that gang rape was a usual part of growing up in the area of Rotherham in which she lived. The report states, just as usual, part of growing up, like your first day at school, learning to ride a bike, or getting a summer job. The impact sexual exploitation had on them was absolutely devastating, it reads. Many children repeatedly self-harmed and some became suicidal. They suffered family breakdown and some became homeless several years after they had been abused. A disproportionate number were victims of domestic violence, had developed long-standing drug and alcohol addiction, and had parenting difficulties with their children. Many suffered post-traumatic stress and endured lasting psychological and emotional damage that diminished their capacity to lead normal lives. The report states, one victim said that sexual exploitation is like a circle that you can never escape from. Even the report author, who has investigated these kinds of atrocities before, was shocked at the horrible nature of the sexual acts and the utter brutality that she uncovered. Quote, it was truly frightening that people in our country could be doing something like that, she said. No, they're not of your race, and they're not really of your country, and you should be killing them. The problem predominated within the Pakistani Muslim community in Rotherham. This raises additional disturbing questions about the culture of this particular group and the corrosive influence of political correctness in motivating officials to look the other way. Events in this town of over 250,000 represents abuses routinely occurring throughout England. They teach us a lot about life in Britain today. The tragedy of Rotherham's children is only possible because of failings at every level of society, in the family, the police, social services, and local and national government. This is about a deep sickness in the British society. You know, it's about crummy, rotten Islamics. And it is sickness shared by many countries around the world, including the United States. For many of these girls, the problem began in their families. The report found that 46% of them had a history of domestic violence. In other words, nearly half of these victimized children grew up in families where the father or some other man around the house was so abusive that he beat at least one member of the family. One-third of the victims were being looked after by the state, removed from their families due to the death of their parents, or, more likely, because their parents were incapable of rearing them. The report makes clear that those responsible for the children failed on many accounts, but the government is looking after a huge number of children. 30,000 were taken into care over the past year in England alone, in part due to family breakdown, and also because of a social system that is far too quick to steal children away from their parents. Britain's care system is overwhelming. With so many children involved, the state cannot provide the guardianship and care these children need. The result is a large pool of children desperate for love and affection, so desperate, in fact, that they will do anything to gain what they hope is love from their tormentors. These are victims that our abusers in Rotherham and elsewhere in Britain prey on. Andrew Norfolk, the chief investigative reporter at the Times, who first broke the story and whose reporting helped bring the scandal to light, described the process of recruiting these girls. Quote, "The victims were always aged 12 to 15. The first contact was in a public place, a shopping mall, a town center, a bus, or a train station, and a growing process developed in which the girls were initially flattered and excited by the attention of young men a few years older than them who took interest, offered the adult thrills of cigarettes, alcohol, and rides in flashy cars. They wanted to become their boyfriends." Quote, "A sexual relationship developed in which the girl is sooner or later asked to prove her love by sleeping with his best friends and then more friends. In the worst cases, the girls were being taken to parties in house and flats or put in cars and driven to locations across the country, always for sex, often violent sex. It starts with girls thinking that someone finally loves them. Too often it ends with them going through a heartbreak and misery and becoming too scared or ashamed to tell anyone about their ordeal. Some become suicidal. Some end up earning their tormentors $325,000 a year as child prostitutes. It is important to note that although Rotherham report talked mainly about girls, boys are also victims. They too suffer horribly. There are far fewer reports of abuse of boys, but this could be that they were even more reluctant to come forward and talk to the authorities than the girls. Uncaring authorities. At this point, the authorities entered the picture, or rather they should have entered the picture, but didn't. Too many simply didn't want to know what was happening. The police treated these girls as adults, capable of making their own decisions in these relationships. They ignored the reality that they were children, being emotionally manipulated and intimidated into doing whatever their tormentors wanted. Professor Jay's report says that in two cases, girls' fathers tracked down their daughters, found the houses where they were being abused, and called the police. See, you can't have guns over there in England, so. But he could have used some other method to put these sons of bitches out of their misery. The police arrived and arrested the fathers. In another case, the police found one of these victims half naked and in bed with a man much older than her. The man was not investigated for child rape. Instead, she was arrested for being drunk and disorderly. Police give no prior, and you thought the policeman was your friend, huh? Police give no priority to these kind of crimes. Instead, the report states that they were regarding many child victims with contempt and failing to act on their abuse as a crime. Several earlier reports were ignored and no action was taken to deal with the issues that were identified in them. Time and time again, school teachers, taxi drivers, and others raised the alarm, but police refused to listen. Why do you want to pay police if they're not going to listen, if they're not going to take care of the problem? Get rid of the cops. Hand out the guns. Let the people take care of it. Local authorities also turned a blind eye to what was going on. In the early 2000s, a Home Office official traveled to Rotherham to induct a report on child sexual exploitation as part of the projected investigating several towns. Council officials allegedly tried to bully her into rewriting sections of the report. She was so concerned with the situation that she went straight to the chief constable of the local police. But even the police tried to bully the official into silence rather than addressing the problem. Finally, the council launched a special police raid, according to the Times. However, it was not against any of the abusers. Instead, it was against one of their own offices, to remove incriminating files. Every file used in the official report was removed. Records were swiped from the computers and names and addresses and photographs of the abusers were confiscated. The official submitted her report to the Home Office unedited, but nothing ever happened. A decade later, it still has not been published. So there's jolly news from jolly old England, but we shouldn't stick our finger out at them because it's going on right here in this country, and at some point, it will be taken care of. At least in this country, you have access to guns. It's absolutely amazing the depth that our race has sunk to. And then the fact that half or two-thirds of the white people out there are screaming at us, or screaming at anybody who tries to take care of it. I mean, it's a topsy-turvy world. The bottom is now on the top. The top is on the bottom. And I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel right now. It'll come, but not right now. In fact, that article was sent to me by Dennis Mahon, who's in federal prison. Even prisoners do something. They send, they watch the newspapers, and they cut out clippings and so forth and send them around. So when you say you don't have time to do something, think, here's guys sitting in a 8x12 cell, and they take the time to do something. So that's the way it goes. Did you know that only less than 1% of the illegal minors are being deported out of this country? Our politicians are all assholes and liars, all of them. None of them are confronting this head on. So that makes them our enemy. Whether it's Obama or anybody down the line, your congressman, your senator. Data released in August showed the authorities apprehended 37,477 accompanied minors at America's southern border in the first 7 months of 2014. At the same time, the nation's 227 immigration judges released more than 37,000 of these into the United States. And I guess they're just wandering around. If they don't have any family up here, they're just wandering the streets. The number of minors who were deported, a mere 280. This is not what politicians have promised the public. Well, of course. For example, White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said on July 7th that most of the kids who go through the process will be found to have no legal basis to remain in the country, unquote. Our message is absolutely don't send your children unaccompanied on trains or through a bunch of smugglers. President Barack Obama told ABC's Good Morning America, on June 26th that it is our direct message to the families of Central America, do not send your children to the borders. Well, so what? You're not going to do anything about it, you dipshit. If they do make it, they'll get sent back. Well, they're not being sent back. Just another lie. Just another lying fucking Obama. But the white Republicans are no better. But as of July, these non-Mexican illegal minors have a 0.7% chance of being sent home. These odds are certain to encourage more illegal minors to breach the U.S. border. The release of these illegal minors comes at a social and economic cost. No shit. The Federation for American Immigration Reform estimated that the state of Texas would spend $12.1 billion on illegal aliens in 2013. Well, they're gonna crush and destroy Texas government. This figure was released before this year's surge in illegal minors and other illegal aliens. This is why they need to use the old state laws to get rid of these people. Back at the turn of the last century, they had this problem with the Chinese, and they constructed laws that could kick them out, and those laws were never found illegal by the federal courts, and so they could be used today. Any state in this country could use those early 20th century laws to deport masses. So it's going to have to come down to the states if they got the guts to do anything. But of course their leaders are all bought off, so they're not going to do anything. It's going to end up with the people. Texas isn't the only state feeling the impact. Illegal minors have been sent and continue to be sent all over the country. Robert Rector and Jesus Richwine, Ph.D., conducted an independent study on the fiscal cost of illegal immigrants to the U.S. taxpayer. They report that as of 2010, all illegal immigrants in the country would cost taxpayers $6.3 trillion in government benefits over a lifetime. That was 4 years ago, well before the numbers swelled to their current levels. While the number of illegal minors that are sent home can be counted in the hundreds, the number that stay in America is tabulated at tens of thousands. Next year it will reach an estimated 142,000. Well, you're telling me nothing's going to happen? Well, I'll tell you, something's going to happen. I don't know where it's going to be good or bad, but you can't keep doing this shit. But for you, for now, keep your powder dry, yeah, and wait. Okay, that's it for today, 14-5. Show's a little shorter today. Let's see, this is Saturday. I'll be back with you on Moon's Day. And keep positive. We'll get it done. We'll get it done. But I'll tell you what, you won't get it done going around to right-wing rah-rah meetings and singing sweet Sieg Heil and all that kind of stuff and listening to the Dukester. And you'll never get it done by swearing. You'll never be violent. Anybody who swears that is a coward and the worst kind of person, the worst kind of white person, because even a rabbit in the right situation will fight back.
Rights. Boy, everyone in this country is always running around yammering about their fucking rights. I have a right. You have no right. We have a right. They don't have a right. Folks, I hate to spoil your fun, but there's no such thing as rights, okay? They're imaginary. We made them up, like the boogeyman. The three little pigs, Pinocchio, Mother Goose, shit like that. Rights are an idea. They're just imaginary. They're a cute idea. Cute. But that's all. Cute and fictional. But if you think you do have rights, let me ask you this. Where do they come from? People say, well, they come from God. They're God-given rights. Oh, fuck, here we go again. Here we go again. The God excuse, the last refuge of a man with no answers and no argument, It came from God. Anything we can't describe must have come from God. Personally, folks, I believe that if your rights came from God, he would have given you the right to some food every day, and he would have given you the right to a roof over your head. God would have been looking out for you. God would have been looking out for you. You know that? He wouldn't have been worried about making sure you have a gun so you get drunk on Sunday night and kill your girlfriend's parents. But let's say it's true. Let's say God gave us these rights. Why would he give us a certain number of rights? The Bill of Rights of this country has 10 stipulations, okay? 10 rights. And apparently God was doing sloppy work that week because we've had to amend the Bill of Rights an additional 17 times. So God forgot a couple of things, like slavery. Just fucking slipped his mind. But let's say God gave us the original 10. He gave the British 13. The British Bill of Rights has 13 stipulations. The Germans have 29. The Belgians have 25. The Swedish have only 6. And some people in the world have no rights at all. What kind of a fucking goddamn God-given deal is that? No rights at all? Why would God give different people in different countries different numbers of different rights? Boredom? Amusement? Bad arithmetic? Do we find out at long last, after all this time, that God is weak in math skills? Doesn't sound like divine planning to me. Sounds more like human planning. Sounds more like one group trying to control another group. In other words, business as usual in America. Now, if you think you do have rights, one last assignment for you. Next time you're at the computer, get on the internet, go to Wikipedia. When you get to Wikipedia, in the search field for Wikipedia, I want you to type in Japanese Americans 1942, and you'll find out all about your precious fucking rights, okay? All right. You know about it. You know about it. Yeah. In 1942, there were 110,000 Japanese American citizens in good standing, law-abiding people who were thrown into internment camps simply because their parents were born in the wrong country. That's all they did wrong. They had no right to a lawyer, no right to a fair trial, no right to a jury of their peers, no right to due process of any kind. The only right they had, right this way, into the internment camps. Just when these American citizens needed their rights the most, their government took them away. And rights aren't rights if someone can take them away. They're privileges. That's all we've ever had in this country is a bill of temporary privileges. And if you read the news even badly, you know that every year the list gets shorter and shorter and shorter. You see how similar it is? Yeah. Sooner or later, the people in this country are going to realize the government does not give a fuck about them. Government doesn't care about you or your children or your rights or your welfare or your safety. It simply doesn't give a fuck about you. It's interested in its own power. That's the only thing, keeping it and expanding it wherever possible. Personally, when it comes to rights, I think one of two things is true. I think either we have unlimited rights or we have no rights at all. Personally, I lean toward unlimited rights. I feel, for instance, I have the right to do anything I please. But if I do something you don't like, I think you have the right to kill me. So where are you going to find a fairer fucking deal than that? So the next time some asshole says to you, I have a right to my opinion, you say, oh yeah, well I have a right to my opinion, and my opinion is you have no right to your opinion. Then shoot the fuck and walk away. Thank you.